So the critical thing to understand is that caring about fairness is not rational or irrational. It just is or isn't.
Hello and welcome to Radio Berkman. I'm Daniel Dennis Jones. After a long sabbatical, we're back with a new season. And for our first episode, we've got a conversation with Yochai Benkler, Berkman Professor of Entrepreneurial Legal Studies here at Harvard University, and the author of the acclaimed book, The Wealth of Networks. We've had Benkler on a number of times before to chat about everything from broadband strategies to WikiLeaks, but he just put out a new book that could turn the world of business on its head. In The Penguin and the Leviathan, How Cooperation Trumps Self-Interest, Benkler suggests that the motivations for human productivity are much more complex than we previously thought. It takes much more than just financial reward to get people to perform, and in fact, research shows that collaborative, trust-based groups tend to align more with human nature. Benkler spoke with David Weinberger about his book and how it challenges what we think we know about human motivation.
Yochai, the subtitle of your book is How Cooperation Triumphs Over Self-Interest. And one of the ways of taking it is that it is a consideration, an argument that we are not purely self-interested creatures. It seems clear that we actually do need somebody to make this argument, but why? How did we ever get ourselves into the position where we actually even have to make that argument?
Well, I think what we've seen, and really the core purpose of the book is to push back on this, is a 40-year trajectory of what you might think of as scientific selfishness. That is to say, from about the late 50s until the early 90s, we see a progression across many disciplines, economics obviously taking the lead, but also political science, evolutionary biology, some aspects of psychology, continuously basically saying, look, yeah, we all talk about morality and fairness, but that's not serious. That's Pollyannish. Serious people look at mathematical models and they tell us that at the end of the day, if you want to get things done, you've got to get the incentives right. And the incentives means material incentives. And if you want to get people acting, you need to monitor them. You need to reward them if they do good things. You need to punish them if they do bad things. All these other things that the mushy people talk about are peripheral to getting things right in terms of the incentives. And we saw this developing in various academic disciplines, but we also saw it developing in companies and company policies starting even earlier, at the beginning of the century, with the rise of scientific management and then Ford assembly line models, where you basically say, I'm going to create a very, very clear set of instructions for what people need to do, and then I'm going to monitor and reward. Probably the most stark example of this are executive stock options that in the U.S. increased executive pay several times over the course of the 90s and were in some sense based on the idea that even the CEO and everybody below only works for themselves. And so if you want to get the CEO right and there's nobody looking over the shoulder of the CEO, you've got to compensate the CEO with stock options so that whatever's good for the CEO is also what's good for the shareholders. What happened in both the real world and the various disciplines is that this story ended up having too much noise. If it was stock options, it turns out that what you got was higher levels of auditing irregularities and essentially short-term as opposed to long-term profits. If it was shop floor, you basically got employees not wanting to do anything other than precisely what's required and monitored and not actually looking to do something new. So firms that were able to change and innovate and get people to actually try to figure things out began to perform better. And in the disciplines, I think what happened since the 1990s is that across this wide range of disciplines, without even reading each other, scientists began to take a look and say, actually, we're a lot more cooperative when you actually look at experiments, at case studies, than the standard model would predict. And I think where we are today is that we're at a point where we're able to step back and say, no, actually, what's not serious is to talk about us as well represented by a self-interested model. We're much more complex than that, and we need to build systems for this new complex view of ourselves as, to some extent, self-interested, for sure, but also concerned with empathy and driven by empathy and solidarity, concerned with what we think is right, concerned with what we think is fair, capable of trusting and being trustworthy, and that's what we need to begin to understand now.
So why did we go wrong? Given, and as your book pretty convincingly argues, there one can make equally good evolutionary cases for cooperative behavior as for selfish behavior. Why is it that the idea came up that evolution could help explain social behavior, why did we run down the self-interest path so long and so hard?
I think the reason that the self-interest model was so powerful combines several factors. The first one is that we have to admit it is at least partly true. It rings true because we all know from ourselves there are points at which we look at something and we say, how is this going to affect my whatever it is, well-being, money, etc. So it's not completely false. It rings to some extent true, and we interact with people who do the same thing. So there's a strong element of truth to it. But it's not the whole story. And so the question becomes, why did we only look at that as opposed to the rest? Part of the story, I think, is that we love clear, simple explanations. Sometimes it's called, by psychologists, cognitive fluency, something that's easy for us to digest. It turns out that when you look at actual people, we're very complicated. It's a lot simpler to say that we can collapse it all into a simple, mathematically describable model that says, if I add more money, I'll get the behavior. If I punish, I won't. So it's simple and easy to absorb. If you look at the historical trajectory, the rise of this belief set more or less coincides with the period of the Cold War. And so that essentially the Cold War very much gets experienced as an ideological debate between a universe that claims to be about solidarism, although in fact, of course, it's about suppression, but claims to be about a collective behavior, and a view that says markets, self-interest, capitalism is what pushes things. So during such a period when there's an us-them, if science develops models of saying not only is it useful, it's true, it is our nature to be like our side says, as opposed to like that side says, then it's easy for us to adopt it. It's not that it's correct, but it's easy to assimilate this idea that everybody acting on their self-interest with punishment and reward, payoffs that are material, that's who we are and we're winning in the war. I think once you get the dynamic running and you get academics writing it and you get business organizations adopting it, you get a new generation of people and that's what they learn, as this is what serious people do. Sure, when your kids share nicely and all that stuff in kindergarten, but the adult thing to do is overcome that and learn how serious people talk. And so as we develop one or two generations worth of students who embed that, then we start looking at the world and everything begins to be reframed in those terms. So all the new evidence comes and gets reinterpreted as really this is about material self-interest, and then you start getting nonprofit organizations thinking of themselves in terms of who are our customers and do we get the incentives right. It becomes the basic mold into which all of the new information gets fit, and then it's much harder to shake free. What's happening is that after 15 or more years of science and practice, we're only now at the stage where we can begin to shake off these habits of mind and look at this evidence that has been grating on the standard model for so long.
And yet that standard model is countered by the initial experience of just about everybody on the planet, which is to grow up in a family, which is under any normal, you really have to start twisting things to see that as a case of self-interest as opposed to a usually cooperative, collaborative, other-directed sort of social structure. So we come out of families, and yet we glommed onto this idea so quickly. I think something that provided cover for that idea is the Richard Dawkins selfish meme, in which it turns out you only care about your kids because it's a way of propagating your own genetic makeup. To what extent do you think the selfish gene was a turning point in this, or a factor in it?
I'm not sure that it was a turning point, because if you look, for example, at political theory, in standard political theory, we should never go to vote. We should just never go to vote, because our marginal contribution to an outcome that we care about in policy, relative to however trivial the burden of going to vote, won't work. That was already beginning in the late 50s. You saw Downs, later on in the mid-60s, Munter-Olson. We saw the tragedy of the commons already showing up in the context of economics and science in 1968. So there are clear precursors to this. The question of whether we actually take that core question of the family and convert it into a self-interested story, that may well be a place where Dawkins's interpretation, which was sound for the biology of the time and then extended to explain somehow that what is valuable for genes to propagate themselves, then says that we should see ourselves as by nature self-interested and capable of overcoming it, maybe thanks to culture, which is what he was really pushing. He was really pushing for a non-selfish society, not for a selfish society, but presenting us as pushing against our basic genetic drive. That may well have contributed to helping. Although you also had Gary Becker and later many others in economics building these simple models of the conflict and love within the family in terms of material incentives. So economics, you had it as well, of trying to basically say, look, this is a general idea. It applies to everything. We'll call anything an incentive and just sum them up. So I think it was an important cultural icon, and it was a contribution, but it was as much diagnostic of a feeling at the time rather than a culprit.
So one of the really interesting things about The Penguin and the Leviathan is that you take some notions that seem so commonsensical and you show that they are incomplete. So you've already talked about incentives, which I think many people take for granted, that of course if you want to change behavior, you change incentives. And you do the same for the other side of incentives, sort of the punishment or disincentive side. But you also spend a fair bit of time on a very old idea, and resuscitating it in a way, which is fairness. What role does fairness play in the sort of rediscovery of our collaborative natures?
I think fairness plays an absolutely central role. And in this regard, some of the most important work was actually done within economics. Experimental economists, most prominently Ernst Fehr from Zurich and his collaborators, but also Sam Bowles, Herb Gintis, and many others, were the ones who really began to work experimentally to look at this question of, do we really care only about the payoffs, or do we care about fairness? And what they did was they set up very carefully designed experiments where the payoffs would be the same one way or the other. You could have zero when you walk home, or you could have something. And systematically showing, this is in a particular model of experiment called an ultimatum game, which was the workhorse of this particular kind of work, where basically the experimenter takes two people and they give one of them, let's say, $10. And then the first one can give the second one some number between 0 and 10. And the second one has only one choice. They can either take it, in which case they walk home with whatever they're given to them, or they reject it, in which case both go home. Now, the standard model uniquely predicts that going home with a buck is better than going home with nothing. And so the proposers will give only a buck because they prefer to go with the most that they can get away with. And the respondents will walk away with the one. And systematically across multiple cultures in hundreds of experiments, the answer is no, that's not what we do. Mostly for offers that are below 20%, people reject. The most common thing people do in market-integrated society is go 50-50. And this was transformative in terms of the discipline, because it turned out people actually cared about the way in which the outcomes were distributed. And then there's more work. Tom Tyler has done, who's a psychologist, has done fantastic work on the way in which communities that are policed respond to policing. And there, the emphasis is on fairness of process rather than fairness of outcomes. There's fantastic work on fairness of intentions, situations where the experimenters will give one side the endowment, just like the first one, but then they'll tell them, you have to give this much or that much, or they decide it by a roll of the dice. And people understand that. When people understand that the other side has no choice and there's no bad intention or intention to treat you unfairly, people are willing to accept much lower returns than when they know that the intention that the person on the other side intended to do poorly. There's an old Yiddish joke about Herschel of Ostopol, who walks in the street with a friend and sees a cookie, and he breaks the cookie in half with one big piece and one little piece, and he hands the little piece to his friend, and the friend says, "Herschel, what are you doing?" And Herschel says, "What would you have me do? What would you have done if you had gotten this?" "Well," says the friend, "had I gotten it and broken it into two and had a small part and a big part, I would have given you the big part and kept for myself the small part." And Herschel answers, "Well, what do you want? That's exactly what I did." But it's a joke because we know that that's not what we expect of each other. We know we expect something different from each other. And so fairness played an absolutely central role in the shift within experimental economics through the work of these economists I mentioned. But it also plays a central role in how we translate from economics to public policy. Because a central theme of law and economics and economic analysis of policy has been, let's get the incentives right, let's get the biggest pie, and then let's leave justice for a conversation later. Let's have tax and transfer, let's have welfare legislation, whatever we have. But fairness has nothing to do with how much we produce. Fairness is just something we do afterwards. We've got to get the incentive right. What this work does is essentially say, no, you cannot expect a society that is not dedicated to fairness, an interaction that doesn't have fairness baked into it, to be as productive as an interaction that does have fairness baked into it. Fairness is not something you do after productivity and innovation and growth. Fairness is something you have to bake into it. And as we sit today and we see the riots in London, and we see the incredibly orderly and law-abiding protests in Israel, we're seeing populations use very different models for basically saying you have to bake fairness into growth. You can't do it as an afterthought.
Well, let me push on that for a moment, because one of the ways of reading the sorts of experiments that you've been talking about and the research that you cite is that the human insistence on fairness, and as you carefully document throughout your book, the definition, the understanding of fairness varies from culture to culture, even from individual to individual. So this insistence on what we call fairness is, in fact, yet another of the brain's irrationalities that we should get over. You know, there are lots of humans make all sorts of poor economic judgments in the sorts of tests that you cite. This is just another one. And so in order to have a rational and higher functioning society, we need to get past this soft and culturally and sometimes individually relative term and sense of fairness. Why isn't that the legitimate conclusion from the evidence that you cite?
To begin with, rationality does not entail self-interest. One, the first generation of experimental and psychological work within economics that pushed back on the model, on the standard rational actor model, focused not on the diversity of motivations, but on the failures of rationality. So, for example, classic, I will pay $5 to get a mug, but I won't give up the mug for $5. So essentially, you've got a mug, you've got $5, and experimentally, people want to keep whatever they have. If I got a mug, I won't be willing to pay it for $5. If I got $5, I might be willing to pay it for a mug. That's irrationality in the sense that you don't treat things under different conditions. You don't treat things as equally valuable when they're just material things. To say that I care about what kind of human being I am, whether I consider myself to be a moral person or not, is irrational, simply doesn't follow. I can care about the color of blue in the sky. That's something that I care about. What the work has done is to show that we are indeed beings that have these kinds of preferences, policies, principles. We are people who actually possess these things and care about them. Rationality then comes in to see, do we or don't we pursue policies that optimize across our multiple motivations? So the critical thing to understand is that caring about fairness is not rational or irrational. It just is or isn't. And the answer is, this is who we are. Now, some of the work in evolutionary biology would explain why, from the perspective of the flourishing of a group where cooperation allows a group to do better than a group of people who don't cooperate, would explain to you why the kinds of cultural practices and preferences for fairness, the cultural practices and educational practices that will lead people to be moral, the kind even of genetically influenced neurochemical responses that would make us feel good about being trustworthy or trusting, about being moral or not moral, would contribute to make it easier for a group to be more or less cooperative. It's not about irrationality, it's about who we are. And if that's who we are, then it's Pollyannish and to some extent silly to say we should ignore all of that, that's irrational, let's just focus on this narrow thing that has some advantages and a lot of disadvantages in fostering cooperation, which is a core dynamic of successive human societies.
You say in the book, but remember what we are trying to do here in this book is not imagine a world that is entirely different and benevolent. What we are trying to do is get a more nuanced and realistic handle on how people actually are and to build systems that respond to this reality. And in fact, the book, I think, does indeed come across as very realistic, is grounded in fact, and is providing an assessment that accounts for so much of what we already know. I'm wondering whether, towards the very end, you talk a little bit about the notion of what it takes for humans to thrive. You introduce the term thrive, which is a very, these days especially, is a very laden term. And I'm wondering the extent to which, even beyond the realism that the book is about and is founded in, the extent to which you see the more realistic picture of the world that you're painting as one that ultimately has value because of the value of thriving.
It's always, for me, both. It's always a question of who we are as human beings, who we are as a society, what sort of relations we have, alongside how can we sustain material welfare and innovation. Because a society of perfectly happy people under conditions of low growth, low material welfare, may or may not be desirable for some people. But I think when you look at the gains in human health, in longevity, in education, and the openness to new ideas, material well-being is a central part of what we have to strive for. And it doesn't help if we build systems that are that only work for some small portion of the population that's particularly altruistic or somehow has a particularly weird and unusual set of preferences. So what we need is to find models that allow us to live materially well. But then there's the question of what do we live for? And so connecting these two, to me, has always been critical. Connecting the innovation and growth with a life worth living. And I think what's heartening, fascinating, entrancing even about this new work, this new scientific work on cooperation, is that it allows us to find ways of living materially well while embracing all of those things that we think of ourselves as decent human beings, decent to each other, decent in our relationships to each other, and that these things actually don't collide, but rather contribute to each other, and we can do both. And that is an enormously attractive image to the extent that we think that it's real. And I think we are at a stage today in terms of the development of the various sciences and academic disciplines of cooperation to say that it is at least a lot more realistic than the model that told us we have to focus on productivity through material self-interest, because otherwise we won't get either what we want for a decent human life or what we want for material well-being.
Yochai, thank you so much for this book and for this talk.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Yochai Benkler is Berkman Professor of Entrepreneurial Legal Studies here at Harvard University and the author of the new book, The Penguin and the Leviathan, How Cooperation Trumps Self-Interest. Benkler will be speaking about his book at Harvard. If you're in the Boston area on October 18th, you can catch his talk. Find out how to RSVP and get a sample from Yochai's book over at our blog, blogs.law.harvard.edu/mediaberkman. Theme music today comes Creative Commons licensed from Learning Music Monthly and TJ Morgan. All of our episodes are Creative Commons licensed as well, so feel free to reuse, remix, or play while holding a boombox over your head outside of your old workplace. This episode of Radio Berkman was produced by me, Daniel Dennis Jones, with David Weinberger at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts.